agree that the term Alaska Pollock would give consumers the impression that the product is from Alaska?
Russian Pollock masquerades as Alaska Pollock with the blessing of the FDA. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a lawsuit in Nome questions a couple's right to have a kennel on their own property.
This is rural Alaska. If you can't mush in rural Alaska, where else couldn't you mush?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
If you're in a supermarket and see a product labeled Alaska Pollock, it could well be Russian caught pollock, and the FDA considers that perfectly legal. U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Maria Cantwell of Washington are urging the Food and Drug Administration to change that practice. APRN's Liz Ruskin explains.
At a recent hearing on seafood issues, Senator Cantwell had a simple question for an FDA witness.
Do you agree that the term Alaska Pollock would give consumers the impression that the product is from Alaska?
Stephen Solomon from the FDA's regulatory division didn't answer directly. But on the FDA's official seafood list, the acceptable market name for the fish is either pollock or Alaska pollock. Same thing, says the FDA. Cantwell says the policy allows Russian fish to masquerade as Alaskan, but she says the Russian fleet doesn't keep to high standards. Cantwell cited the sinking last month of a Russian pollock boat that killed at least 65 crew members.
These lives are being lost because of lack of training and survival skills, and then consumers are seeing a product that's labeled Alaska and it's not really Alaskan pollock.
The Bering Sea pollock fishery is one of the world's most valuable, and it's dominated by companies based in Washington State. Jim Gilmore of the Seattle-based At-Sea Processors Association says Russian pollock is usually processed in China, then refrozen before it's exported to the U.S. And Gilmore says when it arrives, it's priced lower than real Alaskan pollock.
Russian pollock right now that's imported into the U.S. takes about 40% of our domestic market. So being able to call it Alaska pollock when it's Russian pollock has been quite a boon for them.
This problem with the FDA's list of market names is different from the USDA's country of origin rules. Under those rules, Gilmore says, a Russian caught fish can be labeled product of the U.S. if it's substantially altered in America, say, turned into a breaded fish stick.
But if FDA would grant our request, they wouldn't be allowed to call it Alaska pollock. That, we think, is misleading.
Gilmore says the extra irony is that Russia last year banned the import of all U.S. seafood in retaliation for the international sanctions that followed Moscow's move on Ukraine.
So now the Russians can sell their pollock in the U.S. and call it Alaska pollock, and we can't even sell pollock into the Russian market.
The FDA witness at the hearing told Senator Cantwell he didn't know when the agency would decide whether to remove Alaska from the fish name. The request was made last fall. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Final approvals for Shell Oil's exploration season in the Chukchi Sea are expected in the coming days. And while the company is struggling to secure a home port for its ships in Seattle, they're still set to head north by June. As KUCB's Andy Ropeek reports, the Coast Guard in Alaska is proposing a set of navigational buffer zones for when the fleet arrives.
The zones would cover an estimated 28 oil support vessels in Unalaska and Dutch Harbor and about 11 in the Port of Good Hope Bay outside Kotzebue. The Coast Guard wants to keep people and ships 100 yards away from Shell's vessels while they're underway and 25 yards away while they're at anchor. That's the same buffer the Coast Guard used in 2012, the last time Shell was in Alaska, but it's smaller than the safety zones they've set up in Seattle. Commander Hector Cintron, the Coast Guard's prevention chief in Anchorage, says the zones are based on the design of the ports and the amount of traffic nearby.
The safety zones, in general, are simply knitted to ensure the maximum use of the waterways, and that's consistent with safe navigation practices.
The zones will also keep any protesters away from the fleet. In Seattle, the Coast Guard has set up a First Amendment zone near Shell's potential terminal where activists can assemble if they choose. But Cintron says they didn't think they'd need one for protesters in Alaska.
They simply, much like any other mariner in the waterway, they would have to obey the regulation if put in place.
The zones are out for public comment until June 1st. If approved, they'll take effect 2 weeks later in Unalaska, lasting June 15th to July 1st. They last all season in Kotzebue from July 1st to October 15th. That's the same time frame for another proposed buffer zone, one to cover Shell's drillships when they're at work in the Chukchi Sea. It would keep other traffic about 500 yards away from the Polar Pioneer and Noble Discoverer. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
An Alaska Native Village Corporation in Kodiak was the victim of a multi-million-dollar cyber swindle last month. According to a statement by the corporation's attorney, Alutik LLC, an Afognak Native Corporation subsidiary, lost $3.8 million through an unauthorized transfer to a fraudulent account in Hong Kong. According to Peter Boskovsky's statement, a fake email account was set up in Europe under the name of company CEO Greg Hambright, which was then used to perpetrate the fraud. The scam artist sent an email and then phoned a controller at a corporate bank Afognak uses, requesting an urgent transfer of the money to the HSBC bank account of a fictitious third party in Hong Kong. The transaction was not discovered for 2 days, but when it was, Boskovsky says a freeze was requested on the foreign account. The FBI was contacted and stricter money transfer protocols have been put into place. He added that Afognak's company computers were not breached and their customer and shareholder information remained secure. Afognak Native Corporation, headquartered in Kodiak, is a village corporation created under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act for the descendants of people from Afognak Island. It has about 900 shareholders. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, do lawmakers need to bring in a mediator?
I don't know that I'm the right person, but if I can help out, I'd certainly be happy to.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal Housing Lender, Member FDIC.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The legislature has been in special session for 10 days and has held only a handful of budget hearings. On the other issues lawmakers have been called back for, Medicaid expansion and a sexual abuse prevention program, there have been zero meetings. The special session has mainly been characterized by gridlock. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez looks at one way to break it.
If you've been watching the legislature the past few weeks, things have been less like this. And more like this. With the gridlock between the Republican majority and the Democratic minority and the legislative branch and the executive branch, little has been accomplished. The same questions get asked on the state of the budget day after day, and the same answers are given.
I can't say I'm an insider and know what's going on, but as far as the public is aware, they're not doing anything to break the impasse.
That's Douglas Mertz, a mediator and attorney with an office just a block away from the Capitol building.
It's within shouting distance.
Mertz has been following the legislative session and wondering why lawmakers have not reached a deal to close out their work.
They're ripe for some kind of intervention like this public policy mediation.
While negotiation meetings have taken place between legislative leaders and the governor, there has not been a formal structure with a clear, mutually agreeable path to a resolution. Mertz says there could be some merit in bringing in a third party to help guide the key players. and there's precedent.
Things have been done in some other states. In Illinois, for instance, a few years ago, they had a big an issue that the legislature found intractable about telecommunications policy.
So they brought an outsider in to mediate between the stakeholders and come up with a solution.
The legislature enacted it almost unanimously. It was a real turnaround.
Mertz says if he were mediating, he would get the leaders of the Republican majority and the Democratic minority in the same room, with plans to bring in the governor's office at a later point. He would lay out some guidelines.
Well, one of the ground rules would have to be stop blaming the other guys.
As in, no attacks via news releases or press conferences, and no Twitter bashing. The idea would be to focus on the policies instead of the politics.
Break down all the big issues into small, discrete issues, got them to think about what are the blockages here and how we can get around them. Can we engage in some blue sky thinking about different types of resolutions that we haven't thought before?
Mertz would also ask them to consider the costs of not reaching an agreement. In this case, those costs involve the literal expenses of keeping the legislature operating, which can be as high as $30,000 for each day of special session. There's also the risk of government shutdown and damaging Alaska's credit rating if an agreement to fund state government for a whole year cannot be reached. With Medicaid expansion, Mertz says there's the loss of federal dollars that would pay for the program right now, as well as the human cost of poor people not getting health insurance. Mertz has a few other ideas, if legislators are curious.
I don't know that I'm the right person, but if I can help out, I'd certainly be happy to.
And as far as his rates?
They can afford me. Don't worry about it.
Mertz says the legislature could ask the state's chief justice to appoint a mediator if they're looking for a neutral party. But he thinks some sort of conflict resolution could be valuable at this point. After all, it's almost always cheaper than the alternative. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A disagreement between neighbors living several miles outside Nome city limits is set to go to trial. The dispute centers on what's acceptable when it comes to noise and smell from a dog kennel. KNOM's Matthew Smith reports.
The disagreement goes back to 2012, but came to a head in the Nome court in January. That's when the neighbors, Kevin Bope and his wife Lynn DiFilippo, squared off against the Mushers, Niels Hahn and his wife and mushing partner Deanna Hacker. Bope and his wife were asking a judge for an injunction to put a stop to the noise and the smell while awaiting trial by removing the dogs from the property. In the back and forth between neighbors, Bope and his wife say the sound and the stench of living next to a dog lot has made life unlivable. And Bope says the Mushers, who own the dogs, should make it right.
I can't sleep in my home anymore. My home's not a place of retreat anymore. I'd like to live in my home like similar to how it was before the dogs moved in. And it was a peaceful, quiet place, and I can't even come close to that.
But the Mushers, Hahn and his wife, say they're guilty of nothing more than raising a dog team in rural Alaska.
We're about 4 miles outside of the city limits of Nome, and if they're allowed here in town, I think they should be allowed in rural Alaska, you know, an unzoned, unregulated area.
Compounding the issue is the question of who was there first. Documents submitted to the court show neighbors Bope and DiFilippo bought their land in 2004, but didn't build their house until 2008. Mushers Hahn and Hacker already live with their dog team on a different plot of land during that same four-year period, moving out in 2008 shortly before Bope and his wife moved in. They weren't neighbors until the Mushers moved back onto an adjoining lot in 2012 with their kennel of about 30 dogs. That's when the, quote, discomfort and annoyance with the dog noise and odor began, Bope says. Hahn says the Mushers responded to initial complaints by adjusting their training schedules and their feeding times, but Bope says it didn't stop the noise or the smell. Both sides allege bullying and unneighborly, even aggressive behavior from the other. For Hahn and Hacker, the continuing clash pushed them to lead the effort to declare Alaska a right-to-mush state, a symbolic resolution signed by former Governor Sean Parnell last year that signals the state's support for mushing and related activities. In January, the lawyer for mushers Han and Hacker, Bethel attorney Myron Angstman, himself a musher with two Iditarod runs and a pair of Kuskokwim 300 championships under his belt, argued in the Nome court that his clients have a fundamental right to keep dogs in rural Alaska.
If there is a precedent established that outside Nome, 7 miles, you can't have a well-run kennel because your neighbors don't like it, that would be a significant new step in the state of Alaska where mushing is very, very much valued. Being able to say you can't mush in certain places, and this is rural Alaska, if you can't mush in rural Alaska, where else couldn't you mush?
Emphasizing that point were witnesses called during the January hearing, including Iditarod mushers Joe Garney and Aaron Burmeister. Both testified the dogs Han and Hacker keep make, quote, a typical amount of noise for a dog sled team, and both spoke to the importance of mushing in rural Alaska. But John Wiederholt, the lawyer for neighbors Bope and DiFilippo, say the case has nothing to do with mushing. He tells the court it's simply about the noise and odor from the kennel.
It's never been an indictment of mushing or dog sledding or people that own those sorts of things. And it isn't specifically a condemnation of the Hans. They seem like they're nice enough folks. It's just their right to be able to enjoy the property that they originally had.
Lawyers on both sides point to a similar case from the mid-90s involving renowned mushers Dan and Mitch Seavey and the family's Iditarod sled dog tours in Seward. Speaking for the family business, Danny Seavey, son of Mitch and grandson of Dan, says that case spent over a decade in court and soured long-standing friendships, but didn't set any clear precedent for where a musher's right to a kennel ends and a neighbor's right to peace and quiet begins.
The jury found us a nuisance, but declined to issue any damages. I think the total damages were less than $5,000. And then the judge did not issue an injunction. We didn't have to stop, but we were a nuisance. And there was no definition as to now what.
At the January hearing, Kotzebue Judge Paul Roteman ruled against an injunction. The dogs can stay where they are, at least for now. Using the City of Nome's own ordinances for excessive dog noise as a guide, Judge Roteman ruled the noise made by the mushers' dogs would be acceptable within city limits, and therefore acceptable to, quote, a reasonable person in an unzoned rural community. That means the next step for the dispute is a jury trial, with Bope and his wife looking for a permanent injunction and a removal of the dogs for good. That trial is set to begin on June 1st. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2015. Find out more about APU's promised tuition grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message is sponsored by APU.
Fairbanks schools are among several in Alaska and the western lower 48 that have received threatening phone calls. There's been no actual violence, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the calls have prompted lockdowns and law enforcement responses.
Fairbanks North Star Borough School District Superintendent Karen Gaborik says local schools have received a total of 5 calls beginning on March 25th and 30th, and then again in the last 2 weeks as recently as Tuesday. Gaborik describes the caller as female sounding.
The thought is that the caller is using some sort of software or electronic, you know, voice masking device to make the calls. And then they're very concerning in nature. I mean, you know, specific threats to harm children. So, you know, it feels like the caller knows what to say, you know, because a school has to respond when they hear that sort of threat.
Gaborik says the threats have affected 7 Fairbanks District schools, resulting in lockdowns or evacuations as law enforcement responds to assess the situation at each school. Juneau, Anchorage, and Kenai schools are among several others in Alaska that have received the threatening calls. City of Fairbanks Deputy Police Chief Eric Jukes says the caller has not asked for anything or targeted specific people, instead focusing on general violence.
We have had a bomb threat, and the other ones have been you know, threats of becoming an active shooter, those kind of things within the schools.
Deputy Chief Jukes says Fairbanks police are working with Alaska State Troopers and the FBI on the case and trying to find out who's behind the threats, but it's been challenging.
Phone systems have become more complicated over the years, and so it's not the same as it was 20 years ago that you just trace it back to somebody's house. The house and go knock on their door. So it's something that we're working on.
Fairbanks schools have stopped taking anonymous calls from blocked phone numbers. Jukes emphasizes that law enforcement is taking the situation seriously and that although no actual threat to safety has been found, the calls are upsetting. Superintendent Gaborik says it's all happening as schools push toward summer break.
It's very disruptive to the learning process and especially this time of year. You know, I mean, so many celebrations and things going on in the buildings at the end of the school year, but everything stops when you go into a lockdown.
Gaborik says the response to each threat has ranged from an hour to many hours, depending on the school and where they are in the day. She adds each situation involves a lot of communication with school staff and parents, which takes additional time and resources. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Wasilla High School student Ariel Haas has been named a 2015 Presidential Scholar. As Ellen Lockyer reports, the 17-year-old has her sights set on a science career.
Ariel Haas doesn't wonder what she'll do when she grows up. She already knows.
I want to be a physicist. Well, I suppose I should say I want to study physics, and physics is something I'm very interested in, particularly quantum mechanics and theoretical physics and bridging the gap between general relativity and string theory.
Haas, who is in her senior year at Matsu Career and Technical High School in Wasilla, has been selected as one of the two presidential scholars from Alaska who will travel to Washington, D.C. in June for an awards ceremony. The other presidential scholar is Grant Ackerman, who attends West Valley High School in Fairbanks. Haas says she's been involved with math and science ever since she was in elementary school. She was invited to apply for the Presidential Scholar Award, one of over 4,000 students nationwide. Part of the application process is to write an essay about a photo that has personal significance. Haas chose a picture of an early 1900s physics conference.
Because it was the first conference that had a woman in attendance. And in the front row of the picture, you can see Marie Curie. Last year, only three women attended the same conference. We're over 100 years later.
Haas says a lot of women don't pursue degrees in physics, nor are there high percentages of women involved in chemistry or physical science programs. She just got back from the National Science Bowl in Washington, D.C., and noted that few girls make the science teams. She says only 16% of the high school's participants at the event were girls.
You know, it's easy to say that gender doesn't matter, but there's something. There's something that's allowing my male colleagues, good friends of mine, to engage in conversation about the fabric of the cosmos, why I struggle to get a word in, and I see then easily come in and out of conversation as new people walk into the room, but, you know, people who all are male, but I fail to get on the table with them.
Haas leaves Wasilla again for the National Science Olympiad next week. Haas has taken leadership positions by founding the student government in her high school. She has served as president of the Matsu Student Advisory Board and as president of the Alaska Association of Student Governments. She'll attend California Institute of Technology in the fall. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
As the school year wraps up, many fifth graders are preparing to move from protective elementary schools to more grown-up middle schools. For the area's Waldorf school students, that transition includes spears and hand-embroidered tunics. KSKA's Ann Hillman has more.
At the ready!
A group of students stand evenly spaced, heavy black discs at their feet.
Lay of the land!
They scan the area to make sure no one is nearby.
Present to the gods!
And each picks up a discus and looks to the sky, the home of the classic Greek gods like Zeus and Hera.
Find gravity and throw when ready!
The students position their feet wide apart and twist their bodies before hurling the discs. The crowd of fifth grade students and parents is eerily quiet for a sports event.
Why the silence?
Why are they applauding?
Yeah, everyone's being so quiet.
They're wonderful children.
Anchorage Waldorf fifth grader Allie Powell explains.
Well, we're supposed to be quiet because this event, you're not allowed to cheer for separate people.
because it makes people feel bad, because sometimes parents aren't here or friends aren't here that they know.
Ali says that the original Greek pentathlon was held more than 2,500 years ago during times of truce, when Greek warriors would take a break from slaughtering each other to instead compete in sports. The five different events, discus, javelin, wrestling, long jump, and running, taught them useful skills for warfare. Ali says this event is teaching her more about Greek history than she learned in class.
Yes, this is cool. It's reenacting history, so. History is one of my favorite subjects, so.
Winterberry Charter School music teacher Kyle Vandershire attends the event in a gold tunic with white powdered hair. He's dressed as Zeus. He says the yearly event is also a rite of passage for the students as they move from learning about myths and legends in younger grades to history and fact in older years.
So it's that balance there where they will be a lot different in sixth grade than they were in the fifth grade. And we see a big change that in between the fifth and sixth grade year.
Further down the field at Goose Lake Park, Jonah Denier prepares to throw a javelin.
Yes, it's sharp on both sides, so it's very dangerous.
On command, he glides his hand over the smooth red pole and grips it in the center. He looks around, colors flashing from the stitches of the tunic he embroidered himself. He tosses the pole. It arcs through the sky and sticks into the ground a few feet away. He's ready for war. Or at least the sixth grade. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Finally tonight, a correction. Last week we reported a boat recently constructed on Kodiak was the first Unyuk built in 150 years. Instead, it was the first Unyuk built on Kodiak in that time. Michael Poling, who left us a web comment on the story, shared there are at least six other Unyuks in existence. He says he's a retired professor and personally guided the building of four of the boats. He taught at Nuchik Spirit Camp run by the Chugach Corporation near Cordova and worked on bedarkas or kayaks with them before moving on to Unyuks.
I began building the Unyuk at Nuchik Spirit Camp in 2005, but the camp is only for 3 weeks, and there's no way I could finish in that time. It took me three camps, so 2008 was when we actually launched it, a 24-foot Unyuk.
C.J. Christensen's version of the boat is the first to be completed by Aleutic people in Kodiak. It will be on the exhibit in front of the Afognak Native Corporation building for its 20th anniversary on May 13th. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Matthew Smith in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ellen Lockyer and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.